It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Hello and welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in for Carol Castiel. This week, the uses and abuses of social media in war and conflict. Now, it can be hard at times to remember that the internet, at least as most of us know it, is really only about 20 years old. YouTube hasn't even been around for 10 years, and smartphones even less than that. And yet, digital media and devices are now ubiquitous in our lives. There's so much, in fact, that at times they seem to just blur into the background. Now, like any technology, social media is neither inherently good or bad. It all depends on how it's being used and for what purposes. Take Syria, for example. Now, without mobile devices and social networks, we may never have learned of the August 2, 2013 chemical weapons attacks in the suburbs of Damascus that killed anywhere from dozens to hundreds of civilians. It was social media that alerted the world of the heinous attack, which led to the dismantling of Syria's chemical weapons program. That's all for the good. Now, on the other hand, the militant group the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL for short, has leveraged social networks like Instagram and Twitter for their benefit, raising funds, spreading misinformation, and recruiting new fighters to their cause. That's not so good. Well, today we're exploring how social media has become a powerful tool that's used to help and to harm in some of the world's most conflicted regions, and what that may say about future conflicts. Joining us this week, we're pleased to welcome here in our production studios in Washington, Andrew Breen. Mr. Breen, currently an attorney at Steptoe & Johnson here in Washington. He's also a former Department of Defense Associate Deputy General Counsel and Marine Corps Intelligence Officer. At present, he's also an advisor with the Truman National Security Project Defense Council. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Joining us by phone, we're pleased to welcome Corey Dauber. Ms. Dauber is a professor of communication studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where she focuses her work on terrorist and insurgent media strategies, in particular, new media. Her recent publication, YouTube Wars, was published by the Army War College. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, first question to both of you. And Professor Dauber, if I could begin with you. Social networks, as we were saying, really have only been around with us, at least the digital ones, for a very short time. How do you see how they're being used in conflict situations?
Well, you know, historically, terrorist groups have been incredibly creative to jump on whatever media or communication information technologies have been new. I mean, going all the way back to when mimeograph machines or Xerox machines were the newest thing. And that's been true of digital technologies as well. So YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, they are incredibly creative in their use of those technologies. And they use them, as you were saying, to recruit, to fundraise, to spread their message, all of that. And they are incredibly effective and efficient in their use of those technologies, particularly, and this is where my interest lies, in their use of those technologies in a visual way.
And before I turn to Mr. Breen, you mentioned mimeograph machines, which I remember from my youth. I imagine many in our listenership don't remember them, but it wasn't all that long ago. But it seems to me that social networks are magnitudes more powerful than a technology like the mimeograph.
And global.
Right.
I mean, a mimeograph requires, and you're right, by the way, I have to explain what a mimeograph machine is to my students, which is totally depressing. But a mimeograph machine, you've not only got to stand there and do it, you then have to be in physical contact with someone. You have to hand them a mimeograph machine. So you're limited to geographic contact. Whereas digital technology, once you upload, which is basically free once you've made that initial low investment in the technology, you're global instantly.
Andrew Breen, how do you see how these digital social media networks are being used in these conflict zones and regions?
Well, I definitely agree with Professor Dauber that it proliferates technology in a way that we've never seen, certainly in our lifetime. the ability for any group, whether it's a terrorist group or a government or a political organization, just as much as it enables corporate communications and direct consumer contact, it enables constituent contact for any interest group you can think of. And I think I would look at it perhaps a little more agnostically, that it's not good, it's not bad. It's a new element in the strategic communications framework that everyone needs to think about. And I think, to the professor's point, in many ways, these terrorists or insurgent groups in conflict areas, just as they use novel emerging technologies that are cheap and most effective for the purposes of violence like the IED, they rely on non-traditional media first. So we see a lot of use of social media by groups like the Islamic State or formerly ISIL that you mentioned. And I think we can talk a little bit about it later, but I think there are also some definite positive aspects as we see government officials and public safety professionals using these tools to support people in conflict zones.
It strikes me that you use the words novel, new, talking about these new devices, and they certainly are that. It strikes me that they're so novel that I wonder if we really have a good grasp on what fully they can do and how they're sort of evolving in terms of various forms of outreach and communication.
I would just bring up one example of non-traditional fundraising in the wake of the Haiti earthquake. In very short order after the earthquake, and images started to arrive on Instagram, videos on YouTube, we saw the scope of decimation that had never been available unless it was through broadcast news. But we saw it in real time. Simultaneous with that, we saw an unprecedented amount of giving. More than 2 million people texted Haiti to that 90999 number for the Red Cross in the immediate wake to raise funds and deliver goods to help support people in a recovery effort for humanitarian purposes.
Professor Dauber, let's dive in a little bit, and particularly into an area I know is in your wheelhouse, taking a look at how these new tools are being utilized in a few situations. Let's take, for example, Syria and Iraq, and taking a look specifically at the group ISIL and what they're doing when it comes to social media.
Well, I've been looking in particular at their longer videos, so the stuff that posts to YouTube. And it's not as if they have an official YouTube channel. There are several accounts that I sort of consider under the umbrella of that group. And I would say that they are, by an order of magnitude, more sophisticated than any group that has come before.
And in fact, may I just interrupt? We were speaking with an analyst about a week ago on this topic, and particularly how ISIL was using Twitter. And this is a gentleman who lives out in Seattle. He used the exact same words you just did. His phrase was that he has never seen a more sophisticated, strategic, and tactical use of social media by a terrorist organization. And then he added, and frankly, a lot of non-terror organizations as well.
Yeah, if you look at particular videos, it's in terms both of the quality, so production quality, quality of the camera work, just how clear the images are, the quality of the graphics packages that start the videos, and then also in terms of how sophisticated the use of the visuals are. So I was looking at one this morning, for example, where they are recruiting against other groups in Syria. So you have them saying things like, oh, it's a great place to raise your kids. And you wouldn't believe what a great experience this has been. And they'll offer to pay expenses for your wives. And then it shifts to the guy is saying to ones who are not yet in the region, but who might be in the West, laughing into the camera, oh, look at how evil we are. Everybody thinks we're so evil here. They're having a snowball fight. Look how evil we are. We're just having a great time. Come on down and join the party, basically, is the message. And there are a number of videos like that where, you know, I know there's been a lot of talk about the graphic violence, the beheading and so forth, but really the violence in these videos is often very stylized, it's at a distance. And what you see instead is, you know, they're sitting around passing food back and forth. They're cannonballing into a river, right? The message instead is that we're enjoying the camaraderie of the brotherhood. And that's much more the pitch that's being made in terms of recruiting.
Do you think that that would be a successful pitch? I'm probably wrong on this, because if I were to see that, I would think to myself that that is so manufactured and so contrived as to just simply be not believable.
It depends how well it's done, though.
Good point. Andrew Breen, what have you seen in the way of social media use in this current conflict that we're seeing as it's unraveling here in Iraq and in Syria?
Sure. The Islamic State and the use of it by what was formerly ISIL for recruiting propaganda and other purposes also has a blowback effect upon them in the immediate term. So in terms of international consensus and building alliances against their efforts. So in the immediate wake of their kind of lightning advance through Western Iraq, they committed acts and advertised them through the very YouTube videos the professor just mentioned, showing what the United Nations High Commissioner went so far as to say were almost certainly war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think normally in a criminal evidence proceeding, you would not see an official with that level of influence on a judicial proceeding step forward ahead of the evidence and ahead of the fact gathering.
Right.
So you got a small asterisk in those statements at that press conference from the United Nations at that time. However, the videos were so grotesque and so heinous and showed such complete and utter disregard for the sanctity of human life, did not show a shred of mercy, showed combatants laughing as they conducted non-judicial extra executions, mm-hmm. really. And so you see torture. You see mock executions. You see a segment of a video with an interrogation demanding people renounce their religion, and then afterwards they don't, so you see the river of blood flowing from their bodies. So I think, on the one hand, a self-radicalizing potential terrorist may see that and want to join in,
mm-hmm.
but the vast majority of humanity, as they see that documentation created by the terrorists themselves, decides to enhance their resolve to fight that type of activity. So I think, particularly in Western Iraq, as those propaganda videos proliferate, if you're a moderate Sunni or you are a resident of one of these communities, you certainly don't want to live under that type of state, under that type of tyranny.
Just out of curiosity, I'm interested in your thoughts, because the government of Iraq has, in trying to deal with this surge of social media, the images on YouTube, the tweets and that kind of thing coming from, as you say, now the self-proclaimed Islamic State, or ISIL, as we're just going to refer to them, they've just simply decided, well, we're just going to cut off the internet in large sections of the country. As one who knows the military, is that a strategy that seems sensible?
It depends on who's the user, who's their use case. So you're dealing with a terrorist group with an extremely violent agenda, an extremely narrow, focused lens view of the world and what it should be. It runs in stark and direct opposition to our kind of Western civilization held beliefs about freedom of information, about individual self-expression. So in many ways, I think you see a polar opposite effect mm-hmm. of, yes, they will leverage the tools to get where they need to go, but once they have the ability to control those tools, they will be the most active censors you could think of.
Professor Corey Dauber, just looking through some of your writings, I'm curious your impression of what kinds of imagery and video material prove most successful when a group is either trying to make its case or perhaps control the narrative in some way. I mean, we've had two examples here. You know, we've mentioned the extreme images that ISIL has been putting out, still images and video images as well. And then these other videos that you just mentioned, in general, is there a sense as to what works better?
You know, I'll be honest with you, I don't know that we know the answer to that, because there's not a lot of hard data to go on. So we can speculate, we can look at whatever numbers we have in terms of the fact that they seem to be grabbing the lion's share of recruits, foreign recruits going into the region seem to be going to them. Now, whether that's the more graphic videos working mm-hmm. or the more stylized videos working, we don't know. But there just has not been, at least in an unclassified form, the kind of empirical research that we need to know which set of images are more effective in terms of, you know, why is that happening? In what order is it happening? We don't know a good answer to that.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. We're exploring the uses and abuses of social media in conflict situations, looking at how digital technology and mobile devices can both stir conflict and help resolve them. Our guests, Andrew Berene with the Truman National Security Project Defense Council, and Corey Dauber, a scholar at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Now, speaking of the internet, just a quick reminder that you can listen to this and previous editions of Encounter online at our website, www.voanews.com/encounter. And more importantly, you can write to us with thoughts on what you've heard here today and what you'd like to hear more of. Our email address, we read them all, is encounter@voanews.com. Mr. Andrew Berene, it seems that social media tend to be self-segregating. And by that, I mean, when I think of social networks and social media, it seems that like-minded individuals collect with like-minded individuals. If that's the case, the use of social media in terms of recruitment or, you know, the broader idea of kind of controlling or steering the narrative would seem to be fairly limited from the outset. What am I missing here?
No, I think you've hit on something exactly right, that it provides an ability to micro-target a message to an audience or to an individual or to a segment of an audience that can be custom-tailored in itself in ways that we've never been able to do before. You know, the idea of writing a commercial for a TV show that airs to hit a population segment of females between 20 to 35 years old who aren't yet married, right? That's the old model. The new model is that you have audiences that have self-selected for the very media content that's being fed out through these mechanisms like Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or YouTube or whatever the next set of social media tools will be. So I think you raise a really interesting point. The other point on the plus side about all of this activity, to the professor's point about unclassified versus classified analysis of these videos and these social media efforts, is it creates an enormous trail of electronic record and information for the use by allied or really the forces of civilization, if you will, in this type of onslaught against terrorist organizations that would seek to hide in the shadows. It does put them forward. It puts their faces on the internet for identification by operatives in the future. It puts their locations for training campgrounds on the internet. So I think that there are upsides and downsides to the increased activity by these groups.
Professor Corey Dauber, is this something that you've encountered in your study of how extremist organizations use the internet, use social media to communicate? Do they at times do more harm to their goals than good simply by leaving so many digital footprints?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, what's changed with the digital stuff, I think, is that their concerns have changed. So that there's no question that they now give up intelligence information that they never would have in the past. So they unquestionably release information knowingly, I think. Here's how we build IEDs. Here's where we're, you know, all the kinds of things Mr. Breen mentions. But they do it because it is of greater value to them to use the internet for these propaganda purposes. I mean, what changed with the digital world is that previously terrorists cared a great deal about media coverage. Now they take all of that away from the middleman. They don't longer care all that much about the professional press because they control the message themselves. And once they made that turn, it just became more important to them. And they're willing to give up, I think, that kind of intelligence information if they can push out to the audiences they care about the kinds of messaging. It's just more important to them in many cases.
Andrew Breen, I see you shaking your head in agreement.
Yeah, nodding my head. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. As I mentioned about terrorists or insurgent groups or non-traditional political actors being the first to grasp onto this technology and start leveraging it. In many ways, you said, well, all sorts of technologies that are low-cost, high payoff. And I think certainly, to the professor's point, that there is a calculated strategic consideration by these groups about what might be compromised. Mm-hmm. In addition to what they hope to perpetuate about their goals. Now, what's interesting about the ISIS or ISIL case example, as we said, is you can't take things off the internet. So if they do at some point hope to achieve any modicum of recognition as a state in the society of countries, if you will, these videos are going to count against them. They can't be removed. And it's very difficult then to make a transition under the old model of terrorist to political actor to organized state. So I think that they have created a record of their activities that will leave them as villains moving forward.
You know, I'd like to follow up on this. Professor Dauber, this may be a little bit outside your, you know, exclusive research area, but this does raise an interesting point. I wonder if generally insurgent groups or groups that are advocating extreme action may have a bit of a different playing field on social media than when it comes to, say, established governments. These strike me as two very different kinds of messages that these entities are trying to communicate. I wonder if, at some point, terror organizations or extremist organizations may have a bit of the upper hand when it comes to social media, because governments, by and large, aren't putting out images either of extreme kind of emotion-grabbing material. Their message is a little bit more stay the pace, slow and steady, that kind of thing.
Yes and no. It's not that states don't care about appeals to emotion. It's that they are more controlled and more, they color within the lines, right? Look at videos regarding Memorial Day. There certainly appeals to emotion when we celebrate the service of our veterans. But they don't, well, for example, what Mr. Breen was talking about in terms of war crimes. I think it's also criminal when they post videos, as they frequently do, destroying shrines of other religions.
Mm-hmm.
They very proudly film themselves going into shrines and literally taking pickaxes or grenades. Now, that's destroying UN, in many cases, UN cultural or heritage sites. Now, a state simply would not do that. That's a violation of various UN conventions and so forth. So it's not that the states don't appeal to emotion, but they wouldn't appeal to emotion in a way that clearly puts them in violation of various national conventions, codes, or simply cultural norms.
This is Andrew Breen speaking. To add to the professor's point, we are back to non-state actors or non-traditional but politically vested entities. Amnesty International just recently launched a website to help with identification of potential war crimes, potential needs for using video evidence for human rights advocacy, exactly to that point about decimation of religious sites or cultural legacy sites, or even on the more horrific thing, things like extrajudicial killings in Syria. But they launched a thing called a Citizen Evidence Lab, which is meant to help human rights workers, journalists, and citizen activists themselves in these countries to do forensic analysis of videos or images that they find on the internet. Because one of the things that you call them the bad actors or the bad guys will do using social media is they'll take a video from a non-related incident in a non-related geographical area and post it as evidence of some cause that they're trying to promote.
Mm-hmm.
And so by creating tools to help with the forensic verification of the videos, empowering entities like Amnesty International as they pursue human rights, empowering the United Nations human rights workers around the world, I think we see another positive upside to the use of these tools.
Do you think governments are responding adequately in general, or if there's a particular example you want to cite, when it comes to the challenges that are posed by these kinds of organizations and their use of, and in some cases, effective use of social media?
Yeah, I think I'd expand that even. We've talked a bit about terrorist actors or conflict zones where there's personal or violent conflict. I think you also have to think about natural disasters and humanitarian response. I mentioned Haiti earlier in the program, but in the wake of the Pakistan floods, use of videos and images found on social media sites helped to direct supplies where they were most needed, helped with mapping efforts to show real on-the-ground scenarios about where vehicles could and couldn't travel. In the wake of Fukushima, very similarly, in real time, planners that were using it for intelligence purposes for humanitarian relief work used these tools. So I think governments have been a little slower to adopt it than some of the non-government actors. But moving forward, I think you're going to see public safety planners and defense professionals all around the world using this to plan ahead, to make integrated strategic communications that include social and traditional media outlets. And then, as I mentioned briefly with that Amnesty International piece, governments also need to evaluate their sources. And they need tools to do the forensic work as they look at videos emerging on YouTube or images on Instagram.
Corey Dauber, in your work, have you encountered any examples? I know a lot of your work has focused on how we could say bad actors or these extremist groups, these insurgent groups, are using social media. Have you seen any examples of perhaps a civilian population or somebody who also use these tools to, in effect, fight back, to reclaim some of their territory, their security, or whatever has been lost?
I think we have been a step behind from the start of this. And I agree that there are instances and ways where digital media has been used very effectively, but I don't think it's been used yet as an effective counter to terrorist or extremist uses of the material. So we have not yet figured out smart, effective ways to counter message. And I think that's the piece that's missing. We just have not yet gotten very good at that, I'm afraid.
And what would some of your suggestions be to take that step ahead, move forward?
I mean, just to start with, I think at this point, battlefields where we and our allies participate are just by definition awash with digital media. And we ought to figure out ways where we can make sure that we are filming our own activities so that when false claims are made about the activities of American and allied forces, we have digital evidence to prove that those claims are in fact false.
We only have a few minutes left, but I'm curious your thoughts from both of you on this. First to you, Mr. Boreen. You know, some technologies, when they're introduced, you know, have recognized norms and limits. Chemical weapons were freely used during the First World War. Now they're really seen as off the table. Landmines, we've seen similar evolution. Do you see any sorts of evolving limits or sense of norms about the use of social media in these conflict situations?
I want to agree on both points. First, it is too new. I think it needs to evolve. We're going to continue to see where it's effective, where it's not effective. And the non-traditional actors are the ones that will embrace the emerging technologies most rapidly. I also agree that there is a vast unrealized potential for these tools, certainly for the United States government and our allies, to use them to maximum effect as we do our work around the world, trying to make a safer world and a more free world for people everywhere.
Corey Dauber, your thoughts as to this point, to the degree that you're comfortable sharing them?
Well, I mean, I agree. I think there is enormous potential for use by non-bad actors of these kinds of technologies. We have not yet quite figured it out, but this stuff is very, very new. We've just got to be fast and smart in our use of these technologies. We've got to figure out ways to counter message, and part of that is we've just got to make it a priority.
Corey Dauber and Andrew Boreen, we are out of time today, unfortunately. Corey Dauber, a professor of communication studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Her latest book, most recent publication, is YouTube Wars. That's published by the Army War College. Thank you also to Andrew Boreen, currently an attorney at Steptoe & Johnson, and also an advisor with the Truman National Security Project Defense Council. And Counter was produced in Washington, D.C. Thanks to our producer, Anya Zalewski, our engineer this week, Linus Rimkus, and also thanks to Katie Espolita. I'm Doug Bernard. Carol Castiel will be back with you next week. Hope you'll join us then for another Encounter.
Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.